Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical...
sort of.
...podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we will answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
On today's show, we have Pete Devine from the blues band Howl Devine. We're going to talk to him about overcoming addiction and being given the diagnosis of both HIV and hepatitis C. Stay tuned. The opinions on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
How we doing, guys?
So good.
Wait, like really, really good? So or so good?
Joe is confused. Not me. Just
you're
Joe.
The one that's sipping.
No, I'm teasing. I want to just state that I think it's been exactly 2 years since that we've been doing this. I feel like we started around spring 2017. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
we should do another shout out to all our favorite episodes. And then maybe we should also talk about our least favorite episodes.
Oh, that could be mean.
We can't do that.
I know I'm teasing, but it's funny.
I thought you were serious.
I thought she was too. It would be interesting. We could do it. We just can't really air it. No, we love all our guests.
Equally, like they're our children.
Some of them were.
Last week I just wanted to tell you guys a story and see what Joe thought about this. I was running across the street and I clearly was jaywalking and there was a construction worker on the corner and it was at work and I always wear scrubs and that's mostly it, nothing else. And I was sort of just running across the street and the guy screamed at me, "Oh, come on. And you're a nurse. You should know better."
Ooh.
And I was walking right by him and kept walking because I was rushing. It was not an emergency. I did not need to jaywalk. That is my fault. But then I looked at him and I'm like, actually, I'm a doctor.
What a dick.
And then he said, that's even worse.
Wait.
And then I was like, is it worse? Because I feel like he was sort of crapping on nurses.
Wait, was this done in like a flirtatious way? Like he thought
this was
a good line, or was he really like chiding you for this?
He was chiding. He was like a little bit annoyed that I jaywalked, but more annoyed that like I should know better, but I felt like him saying like
stupid. He's not at the hall monitor. That's what he
I mean.
Was.
That is,
and then he stereotyped by calling you a nurse because you're a woman.
That was the problem. His job is to yell at people to cross the street. His job is the safety person of this like corner that was being worked on. But yeah, I think that it was really derogatory, and I'm not demeaning nurses at all, but just to assume a woman in scrubs is nurses.
Yeah.
And then when he said it's worse that I jaywalked because I am a doctor.
Like they're better
assuming,
than nurses or
right.
something. Yeah.
The whole thing. And he
without
didn't say anything about how nice
did
my
he,
ass is.
Did he respond when you told him, when you're like, I'm a doctor? Was he like, oh, it's just because you're a lady. And then were you like, I'm not a lady, I'm a man. Just to like really confuse him.
No, that would have been awesome. No, I think a little like whistle cat call would have made me feel better. But the words that came out of his mouth just mostly annoyed me.
Yeah.
And it does remind me of times at work or at parties or whatever where, I have patients who'll be like, hi, Ms. Ross or whatever. And I'm like, it's actually doctor. You know, I've spent a lot of time and money on that degree, and you should call me doctor, because I don't allow it when people call me miss unless they're like 90 and like a little old lady or whatever. But I definitely correct people.
Really?
Yeah.
What about you, Kaveh? Would you correct
do they
people?
Call you miss?
Because I miss.
Not like if someone
it depends
says
on
Mister,
what kind of mood
because
I'm
I've seen
in.
Both.
Sometimes
I've seen...
I feel pretty. Sometimes I don't.
It depends how much facial hair you have.
Exactly. If I have a beard, then I'm really surprised.
Yeah.
But. Yeah. Do I really actually get upset if they don't call me doctor?
Do people call you Mr. Hoda? Do you get that?
Every now and then. Every now and then.
And do you correct them?
And I will, but jokingly mostly. I'll be like, I didn't go through 4 years of evil medical school to be called Mr. Evil.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I like it's... But it's different because I don't have to deal. No one's ever confused me for a nurse or a tech or something like that. So it's a little of a different vibe. Yep.
I don't chide people like this construction worker chided me. I'm not mean about it, but I say, actually, you know, I call them out on it and I try not to make it contentious because usually I'm about to sedate or scope them.
You know, there is one thing that happens to me that probably doesn't happen as much to you, and it's weird. And I don't know if it's because my name is a little bit more unique, but they'll have a hard time with it. They'll see my name and they don't know if my first name is my last name, so it really confuses them.
Yeah.
So they'll be like, Dr. Cave, or like the Cave, and I'll be like, you know, it's actually not my name, but you know, not my last name, you know. So I think that's just because of the nature of my name more so than anything else.
Yeah. And then they don't call you Ms. Cave, so
not enough. I have a how to be a better patient segment thing I kind of want to do.
Okay.
And it's a real simple thing that people can do. And it's like the number one issue. And we've talked about this to some degree, but it has to be said again. The one thing that people really just cannot nail, and if our show does nothing else in helping people communicate with their doctor better, when did this start? The correct answer to that is either a specific time, a general time, or I don't know. I really can't tell you when. Any of those three things would help answer my question. If it does not fall, if your answer does not fall into one of those three categories, my brain will start to shut off.
Yeah, you know, you're sounding like kind of a dick, honestly. Well,
but this is important.
As a patient?
No,
I'm like 5 years old.
But you'd be surprised.
I mean, personally, but...
I don't know if he's coming off angry,
Carry on.
But I totally agree with exactly what Cave is saying.
Okay.
So you're seeing with a patient, you have a limited amount of time. We have questions that we ask specifically because it'll help us get to an answer. And we have, and patients have a lot of information they want to share, and sometimes it is useful. A lot of times it's not. If you have a good doctor asking you questions, you kind of have to trust the process. So if I say, Joe, when did this pain you're complaining in your stomach start? And you answer with like, well, I've been working at this new job, and sometimes I watch TV late at night, and that starts
to
happen.
You get a lot of that, honestly?
Probably once a day.
My most common thing is I'll say, when did this start? And the patient will be like, oh, for a while. Right. I literally have no idea if that's a month to you or a year to you. Yeah. Or some of our patients who maybe don't speak great English, I'll be like, since before.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, you know, still, if you don't speak English, since before what? Or if, you know, it's just not a number. One month, one year, 10 years.
Or if you don't know either, that's okay. Because then that tells us it's probably been kind of a gradual process. It's been going on for a long time, and it's been subtly sort of becoming a thing. So we can actually get information from that as well.
Did something happen recently that you just want to remind people?
It happens very frequently. And these are like patients that I love too. And I will stop them sometimes now. And because I have a relationship with some of these people, I'm like, no, come on now.
Come on. You know me.
What? I'm a good doctor. I'm very good at getting the diagnosis, but you have to work with me here. Okay. So I know. And sometimes they want to share these things that I may not find important. I agree. They have to have space to do that, because sometimes they'll say something and I'll be like, oh, that's great. But I will give them an opportunity for that. I'll be like, is there anything else going on?
Right.
I will always make sure that there is a time for that. But you got to work with me when we're doing these questions.
I think maybe I could squeeze my venting into how to be a better patient as well. Like, for example, my patient who I recently saw, who has a very healthy lifestyle, as a vegan, does yoga, exercises, you know, 3 to 4 times a week, and then tells me that sometimes he uses a little bit of heroin and a touch of cocaine. And I'm just like, you know, thinking to myself, oh, you're telling, and he also is one of the nausea, vomiting, or kind of pain that shatters, you know, like these words that are very poetic and beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Like my shattering, crushing.
Ooh, I like it.
Pain and
really
stuff like that, like a waterfall.
Oh, and I'm like, I, is great, I don't, actually.
This does not compute.
This is not falling into my algorithm.
Right. I try to be flexible and like listen well and sort of do, you know, active listening and all this good stuff. But like there are certain words when you say that your belly is shattering, I'm like, meh, you know, no, I don't know.
I actually kind of like that guy.
That is pretty good, actually. Yeah. But I'm just saying the vegan, holistic person who comes to me who dabbles in heroin or cocaine and won't do like, you know, a diet that I recommend because they're not interested or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I find that that's a common problem where someone will come in and they'll come to me and I have specifically one frame of mind to approach medical problems with, and I will offer a solution and they'll say, no, I'm looking for a very different like approach. And I'll be like, okay. I mean, I'm not gonna come out here and say that Western medicine has the complete handle on all medical issues. There's probably different ways to approach certain topics, but I don't know them. That's not my thing. So you're not going to come to me and get like treatment with Reiki therapy.
Right.
You're going to get the stuff I do.
Right. And when patients are like, well, I don't really like medicine and I don't really like procedures. And I'm like, well, these are my expertise.
That's like my two things.
This is who I am. This is what I do. Take it or leave it. Like I know Western medicine and I can offer certain procedures. You know, we don't just do procedures for fun or for money. We do it, I think, for good indications.
Yeah.
But people don't, I don't think accept that sometimes or don't want to be, they say most commonly, I don't want to be a guinea pig.
Yeah, right.
Like I'm not asking that of you.
Oh, well, that feels better. I feel like we got something off our chest. I feel do. Better, don't you?
I do. Joe, do you feel
I
better?
I hate you too, more than ever.
So it's good therapy for us.
It is good therapy. Speaking of therapy.
So our next guest is Pete Devine. He is a drummer in a band called Howl Devine. It's a really great blues band here in the Bay Area. And he has an amazing story of addiction, sometimes some despair, disease, being diagnosed with HIV and HCV. And his story ultimately ends in, I think, a pretty happy one. And it's a pretty good place for us as doctors to really sit and hear it out and to get the details from a patient's perspective. So stay tuned. It's a great interview. And before our next guest, I just want to plug our Facebook, The House of Pod, a medical podcast, our Twitter, which is also at The House of Pod, as well as at Instagram, at The House of Pod. Make sure you have liked and subscribed us on iTunes. Please leave us a rating. It does help get new listeners to the show. On today's show, we have Pete Devine of the blues band Howl Devine. He has a story of addiction, disease, and ultimately redemption. Pete, thanks for coming on and sharing your story with us.
Thanks for having me on. It's very cool to be here.
So it is important for us to talk to patients in sort of long form like this because, you know, in our clinics, in our meetings, we have very limited time. And I think a lot of our listeners who are in the medical profession, and I think a lot who aren't as well, would like to hear some of the story that you got. And you have, I think, a lot of aspects of your story that we can learn from.
I was probably addicted to smoking pot and alcohol and stuff at a very young age. And also in Maine, that's what you do. It's cold during the winters. You know, a lot of people drink a lot there. So the drinking culture is heavy in Maine where I grew up. It's like a fisherman town off the coast. And so I started young and, you know, doing lots of drugs all through my teens and 20s and stuff, and it progressed. I became an intravenous drug user around 2000, and I did that for 11 years every day. Horrible drug addict.
Oh, seems like a big
so
step
bad. It was a big step. Yeah.
When you say, you mean heroin when you say that, is that like,
well,
when
it was first heroin, and then I wanted to get off the heroin, so I started doing meth to get off the heroin. So I started shooting up meth every day, and for a while it was both. Towards the, like, for the bulk of those 11 years, I was using drugs intravenously. It was probably meth most of the time. Mm-hmm. And then I got clean in 2011, and I've been clean since then.
We'll get to that, but what was the theory behind using meth to get you off of the heroin? Is that like something that people with addiction have done? Is that something that's like a known tactic? What was your reasoning?
Did it prevent you from feeling dope sick?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a common thing with drug addicts, like maybe, you know, trying to get off one thing and substituting another drug to take over for whatever reason. It helped me with the dope sickness, as you say. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously with the whole OxyContin and fentanyl abuse and all these accidental deaths, I personally have read so much about it in the last year with Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family being sued and all, you know, there's been so much media attention just in 2019 about this stuff. And you just read all these personal stories, and maybe this is your story too, the reason for continued abuse and stealing and all the awful things associated with drug use is to prevent this feeling of dope sickness, which is a feeling where you feel like you're going to die and you're crapping your brains out and you have chills and you can't get out of bed.
It's true.
And the only thing to fix it is another hit. But people do not die from that, right? I mean,
you don't die. You don't die from withdrawal from heroin. You die from withdrawal of alcohol, yes. But from heroin itself or from opium itself, you don't die from withdrawals.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was sick and I didn't want to be sick. I tried so many times to kick dope and I couldn't do it. I went to Amsterdam and I even tried to kick, like, where it's legal, and I tried to kick there and I couldn't do it. It's just like, the thing that got me off the heroin was the meth, which is disgusting in a whole different way. I'm looking back on it now. It's just like, wow, I really did that for so many years. Like, I shot up multiple times a day. That was my life and I survived it. And it's just like, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty disgusting when I think about it now. I mean, for me, it kind of is just like,
what was your,
that was a whole different life.
What was your bottom?
My bottom was, well, in the process there between 2000 and 2011, so I, you know, each year my life would like become more crappy and just like my health would decline and everything would start to fall apart. That's what happens with an intravenous drug user. You know, you can only sustain for so long and in the quality of life, really. So I contracted HIV in 2006 and, that could have been from sharing needles. That could have been from having unsafe sex. I'm not sure, really. I guess it really doesn't matter. But and so that was 2006. And then around 2008, even a couple of years after that, I contracted hepatitis C. And so, like, so I guess to answer your question, my bottom was I was sick. I wasn't on medication for the HIV. I wasn't taking antiviral medication. And so I was, like, having many... This is my doctor at one point down at General Hospital said, you have the body of a 60-year-old man. And this was when I was like 38 or 40 years old. And I was just having all these weird things happen, like shingles and just like old people's diseases, you know. And
so you were seeing a doc. It's interesting because what I'm trying to sort of piece together is what your life looked like while you were in the middle of this real addiction. It sounds like you were still seeing doctors, like during the course of your addiction. You're still going to see doctors. Were you still like holding down a job? Were you holding down? Because in our minds, we think of like Sid and Nancy and some sort of like heroin den. We think of drug users who are really addicted, like not leaving the house. But you were like somehow maintaining some semblance of a life, it sounds like.
I was for quite a few years. I was like, I was playing my gigs and I was able to play my gigs, play music. And then after the gig, I was just like off to the races. I'd go find my drug dealer. I'd take any money I could from that show and go to my drug dealer and spend it all on drugs pretty much. And, you know, and just like I would be up maybe for a couple days after that. And I might have a gig like 2 days later and I'd come to my gig and I'd be all like cracked out of my head. And it would be a challenge to play. And the more I did this, the worse my situation became and the more my life around me fell apart. I was seeing a doctor and they wanted to try me on HIV meds and stuff, and I just couldn't adhere to taking my medication every day because I didn't wake up at home half the time. I was just like, I was not capable of taking my medication every day.
Did you tell your doctor that? Or
yes,
did you try it and you just couldn't do it?
We tried and I couldn't do it.
Well, it was also probably a harder regimen in the last 10 years, as you probably know. I mean, that the regimens have become easier, like sort of single day dosing instead of three pills a day,
exactly.
three times a day
or twice a day.
So sometimes it is maybe easier for someone who's using now to take the medicine. I don't know, but I think 10 years ago it's probably really challenging.
It was more challenging. Yeah, you have to do it twice a day. I recall, a dose twice a day.
And it's hard to know. You said either unsafe sex or needles, and it doesn't really matter. Like you said, we have a lot of patients with cirrhosis, and I sort of say, if you're not doing anything bad now, it doesn't matter. But in the end, the only reason why HIV would matter is so that you can tell people that you might have slept with.
Exactly. You know? Yes, that matters. Yes. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I guess when I say it doesn't matter for me,
I know what you meant, but I just want like our listeners to know that if you think that you have something like that, Hep C, Hep B, HIV, herpes, or we talk about that. We tease Joe a lot on the show about it as a joke.
Oh, you have herpes, Joe?
I don't have herpes, Pete, but
we want our listeners.
Kind of a I'll fun kiss rumor. You then.
That's we okay. need our listeners to think that he does. So please stop messing up our brand, if you will. Did you ever? I mean, Kaveh asked what your bottom was, and I'm not sure.
I haven't
if we hit
even
that
hit
yet.
That part,
right?
Yeah,
no. But did you ever overdose? Did you ever need Narcan and, you know, the...
No, but I think I might have. I was starting to, but I counteracted that with a hit of meth. Some messed stuff.
Yeah.
Don't recommend that to our listeners.
I don't recommend this. I don't recommend, you know, it was a horrible life. And towards the end, I did hit a really bad bottom. You know, I was just like, I was pretty much homeless. I tried a few different rehabs in the city. They didn't work. I was like bopping around the Tenderloin, staying at people's places. I was homeless and I was sick a lot of the time, and I was using drugs all the time. And I had no more gigs. The bands I was playing with, just like, they had it with me.
Drummers are hard to deal with. Even sober drummers, I'm looking at Joe, are hard to deal with, much less one dealing with a heroin problem.
Yeah, is that true? You know, or you're just digging
no,
on
that's
Joe?
Drummer, it's a whole thing. It's a whole issue. I love our drummer. Yeah. I love
you know,
Joe.
It's just like this. It's true, though. There's so many great drummers in the city, so many great musicians. It's really competitive, and you got to be on the ball if you're going to make a living doing it, and if you want to make any, you know, mark in this world playing a music or an instrument, you got to be good. And so doing being an intravenous drug user like totally took all of that away from me. And it's really interesting. I had a friend, I don't know if you guys have heard of Music Carers as a program.
We did. From Pat Spurgeon told us about Music Carers.
Another drummer from Rogue Wave.
He was a guest on our show a few months ago, and he was on, his kidneys failed and he needed a new kidney, and he's like, there's a great program, Music Carers. So
that's amazing. Yeah, they're so great.
Will you tell us about it?
Well, I knew nothing about it. It's a program subsidized by the Grammy Academy. It's a part of the Grammy Academy. It's one of the, you know, it's a program that, you know, if you're a musician or in the music business or producer or anything like tied to the music business, and then, like, if you need an operation or something like a new liver, or if you need housing, or if you need hearing aids or something, if you lose your hearing, like, there's a whole slew, you know, of different things they'll help you with. And a friend had told me he had gone through a rehab in LA, and Music Carers paid for it.
Which scared you more? Hepatitis C, getting that diagnosis, or HIV? And just to give a little historical perspective, when you were diagnosed, the treatment for both of them were not fantastic. Now, essentially, we have cures for hepatitis C. We can control HIV pretty well, but at the time, they're both really scary. So what was the scarier of the two?
I think at the time, HIV was the scariest for me at first. And it kind of also set me into a tailspin. Like, when I was diagnosed with HIV, I kind of became like, what the hell with it, you know? And I became more reckless and didn't care so much. And, more kind of like, you know, my life is over. What the hell? I might as well just do lots of drugs and just like not give a damn anymore. When I got Hep C, I didn't really know a lot about it. And I didn't know, like, you know, it's kind of, I guess you call it the silent killer or something. It's like, it just, like, so many people.
We use that term a lot.
I was like, I think that's diabetes. Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Or hypertension. No.
I have heard it referred to that, but I think people are, it's just something that it means you can die from it but not have like some weird like rash on your body because of it. But
you cannot know about it. You can have it for so long, exactly. and then all of a sudden you can go from fibrosis to cirrhosis and not even know it, and then you can be screwed.
It is. I mean, it's just like diabetes, high blood pressure, you know, hep C, hep B. You feel totally fine until you might die. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's why.
Yeah.
So what scared you, do you think, more? Was it like the risk of death, knowing that it was that, or were you afraid, oh, who am I going to find that's going to love me now? Was there like a fear of like finding a partner? Was it, what was the fears that you were having when you got those diagnoses?
That's a good question. I think one of the biggest fears I had was, I'm going to be alone. I'm not going to be able to fall in love or have a partner or have a family, or have any amount of quality life because I'm going to die in a few years.
Yeah.
And I really didn't know the treatments back then. I knew really nothing about HIV in 2006 when I was diagnosed with it. And one of the great things about my doctor down at General at Ward 86 is they taught me, you know, that it's not a death sentence anymore. And it wasn't a death sentence even in 2006. Like you say, there was the treatments weren't as good as they are now, but they were still pretty good. They were a lot better than they were in the 90s, you know, when you had to do like the cocktail and all that crap and tons of side effects. And
well, our focus now for HIV is to think of it as like a chronic disease. Make sure women get their mammograms, men get their colonoscopies, because people are living normal, healthy, long lives because we're doing such a great job.
Absolutely.
I have a question about, I guess, sort of stepping back with the just substance abuse. Do you think that you just sort of got into it as a kid, or do you think that you were self-medicating? Because we're talking about joy and like family and love. And do you think that you were medicating yourself for depression, anxiety, or whatever? Or do you think this was just sort of this cycle of like, I was a kid, I started stuff, and I just kept going, you know?
That's a good question. You know, we all have problems from like, you know, things that happened to us in our childhood that affect us, you know, some more than others. It could be like a parent died or something, or you're abused sexually, or you're abused physically or whatever. I guess, you know, I started at a young age. Maybe, I mean, I guess I'll get really personal here, if that's cool.
Sure.
Like my biological mom killed herself when I was like 6 years old. And maybe so I had a fear of abandonment or something as a child. I think that might have been one of the things.
Yeah.
When I was like 12 or 13, I was badly sexually abused by a camp counselor. And I was, you know, and that kind of messed me up too. So like, you know, there's a couple things I might be able to attribute wanting to self-medicate for.
Sure.
But ultimately, I think the bottom line is I enjoyed getting high. I enjoyed, you know, getting a buzz on, whether it was from booze or smoking pot or doing acid as a kid.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it just could be a combination of all those things. And also another one is I have a predisposition, I think, is, you know, addiction and alcoholism runs my family. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My dad was. Both my brothers are addicts and alcoholics. I'm the only one who's clean. I mean, my dad passed away. My grandfather's passed away. One of my brothers passed away last year. My other brother is living in Japan, and he's just like, his liver's like, and kidneys are shot. I mean, he's going into the hospital every other week for dialysis and stuff. He's a mess. From drinking.
So you started off with a couple of strikes against you.
Absolutely.
Like,
and
dealing with what you had to deal with when you were young. I mean, we're not psychologists or psychiatrists, but you don't need to be one to recognize that something like that's going to leave a lifelong effect.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's going to predispose you to health and psychological problems.
Absolutely.
Have you been able to get counseling from that end? I mean, it sounds like you've gotten all the good medical care and all the treatments and all the, and we'll get to that in a second, but have you been able to get counseling?
Yeah, I've gotten counseling, and I've done a lot of just like soul searching and like talking with friends and my wife. I'm married now, and she knows my, you know, she knows my story. We talk about this stuff all the time.
I'm like, we just met, so if I know this, I'm sure your wife knows.
You know what? I'll tell you. It's just like, I'm an open book.
It's great. Like, what motivated you to share your story?
I think sharing my story is a form of, you know, of
like therapy.
Therapy. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the more I talk about it, the more therapeutic it is.
Yeah.
I think it's a good way for people in recovery to be.
Well, you've been great about it. You've been really open about sharing. You've literally become the poster child for HIV, HCV treatment. And by that, I mean your face is all over posters in San Francisco.
That's true.
Advertising. I remember it was like a year ago. I was walking by a poster. I'm like, what? Pete? I saw you on the poster.
Yeah.
I didn't know. And I didn't know until that point. So it's great that you decided to share that.
What is the advertisement
for? It was like for UCSF, and it was like about their HIV, HCV treatment. It's like a picture of Pete with his drumsticks. And
nice.
It's like Pete was like, you know, homeless and addicted to IV drugs, and now he's in a successful band. It was like he's literally the poster child for how good treatment can be.
Yeah. About how, you know, you can take that one pill a day and obtain a undetectable viral load and live a healthy life and do normal things, get married. You can even have children and be HIV positive. It's really amazing how.
Right. With the kids being HIV negative.
With the kids being HIV negative. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. As long as one of you are undetectable and you're on the antiviral medication.
So can I ask, so you went to LA, you got clean. And are you on any methadone right now?
Because
I don't know, to get off of heroin, a lot of people are on sort of a very strict regimen of a low dose methadone to prevent this dope sickness. And it works. And people have normal, healthy, functioning, long lives on a little bit of methadone, which is related to heroin every day. You know,
everyone's different. And if that works for them, that's totally cool. If people want to go to NA and AA every day and that works for them, that's totally cool. I don't do either of those things. And you know, it's just like kind of like quitting smoking cigarettes, like, but you're doing the vape things and they're, you know, it's just like, you're not really quit and you're still addicted to something and something still, there's still a little bit of a monkey on your back.
Right.
But like I say,
it's
better than using.
And same thing with
everyone's
vape.
Different. But for me, I so it's like all or nothing for me.
Right. And same thing with vaping for Ireland. Like it's meant to be a short term crutch to transition off of cigarettes.
Yeah. But people just go on for years.
No, I agree. That's not the right thing. Sorry. Yeah.
Hey,
Joe.
Pete, thanks for sharing your stories. This is amazing. I just have just a basic question.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who's addicted to cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
how did you quit? I mean, I'm sure you get that question all the time. It's a lot of it's willpower and whatnot, but I feel like cigarettes are like almost like food where if I don't have it, I'm starving. Like, how do you push through that, would you say?
Well, that's a good question. And the bottom line is I didn't want to die, you know, and I was using such a powerful drug with the meth and the heroin, but mostly the meth towards the end. And it was such a powerful drug, and this is like, I couldn't sustain my life. I was either like sink or swim, and I didn't want to sink. And so I made a decision. I had tried many times over my life. I must have been in like 6 different rehabs from my teenager, like maybe 3 or 4 in the last 10 years. And I finally told myself, you know, I'm either going to die. I'm too old for this. I can't keep going. I'm too old. And I hit a point when you're like, you know, 40, 45. It's just like, if you don't quit smoking and then if you don't quit doing these drugs and then by then your body is not going to be able to heal so well after you hit 50. And then you might really start to run into health issues, like especially with the smoking, you know, like, so it was just sink or swim and I didn't want to sink. And I quit smoking cigarettes too. I was in a rehab in the summer. It'll be 8 years this summer. And then 3 or 4 months later, I quit smoking cigarettes too, cold turkey.
Wow.
And I had to do that. And the reason for that was like, okay, I've done all this work to get off drugs.
Yeah.
And I'm working to be healthy. And wouldn't that just really suck if all of a sudden I was diagnosed with lung cancer or some, you know, terminal, you know, thing from smoking cigarettes. So I got to quit smoking cigarettes because
you're feeling like a hypocrite if you're clean in one aspect and not in another. Right.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Yeah. In a way. Yeah.
It's a real challenge because when you are quitting something, when you talk about addiction, a big part of it is there's this reward cycle that goes on in your brain. You know, you worked hard, you played your show. Now it's time to get high. You know, do you feel like you've replaced that with something else? And if so, if you had advice for other people trying to quit, what would it be?
Pornography?
No, that's go. No, that.
What's wrong? There's no problem with porn. We'll talk about that in another show.
No, I'm not suggesting there is. I just thought it was funny.
You know, that goes in hand with the doing the drugs and the math and stuff. That's just like a whole part of that life, that past life. It's like not only was it drug addiction, but it was sex addiction, and they go hand in hand. And that was part of my story too. So the exact opposite. I mean, I was afraid to have sex even like in the first year after I got clean, because it kind of triggered off, you know, it's a trigger for me.
Right. Cause then you're like going to need a cigarette after sex or a drink or whatever.
Or I'm not going to be able to have sex unless I shoot up and have sex. Like that's the thing about meth, and it's really gross, but it's true. You know, it's just like, you know, a lot of drugs, stimulants, and they go hand in hand with sex, and it becomes a dual addiction of sorts.
Yeah.
So not the pornography, but really what helped me with that was getting into my music, playing music full time, putting all of my eggs in one basket, which I've always kind of done anyways. I've always been a musician. I've never had another job my whole life. It's always been music since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And even when I was an active drug addict, in the back of my head, I always knew, like, if I got clean, I'm going to do pretty damn good. I have this music. I have a God-given talent, and I think I'm already very good. And I know if I can get this monkey off my back and get clean, then I might excel and I might do really well. And that's what happened.
But you didn't because it sounds like a big part of your drug use was kind of around music. So was it a problem for you to play music and not get high? Was that an issue? Or
you know, it's funny. It's almost like I had two separate lives when I was playing doing drugs and playing music. Like, sure, with the marijuana and the booze early on in my teens and 20s, that kind of went hand in hand with the music, being in clubs and drinking and stuff. But, you know, ultimately, even back then when I was drinking, I knew I wasn't a better musician when I drank. I was always a better musician when I was clean. Mm-hmm. Same, and I tried when I was doing the intravenous drugs and the hard drugs in my 30s and early 40s. I tried to separate the two, the music and the drugs, and I couldn't do it all the time because, you know, a couple of days would run into a next gig and I wouldn't have slept and I'd be cracked out, you know, just like, you know, whatever. And I'd have to play the gig and I didn't play as well. So I was able to separate those two things, and I'm very lucky for that. Most of my friends in the bands, they weren't drug addicts. They weren't doing the same things I was doing. So I would play my gigs and then leave the club or the gig and then go off with a whole different set of friends and a whole different set of, you know, whatever, and do the drugs. And
it's terrifying, you know.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit more about where you're at now.
Where I'm at now, well, I'm in a pretty good place. I've been clean for 8 years this summer, totally clean. I'm available, you know, for life. I'm not fucked up all the time. I guess I'm not, like, you know, I'm not afraid anymore of everything like I used to be. I'm married now. I learned how to drive a car after I get clean. My bands are doing really good. Yeah. I have a lot more friendships and relationships. My relationship's great with my sisters and my mom and my family. My health is really good. I'm on medication for the HIV, and my viral load is undetectable. My cell count's really high.
Tell us about Hep C.
Thank you very much. I got treated for Hep C like 3 years ago. I did the Harvani treatment for 3 months.
Yeah.
And I cleared it 100%, and I don't have it anymore.
Excellent.
Yeah. And I was like somewhere, I was like stage 3 fibrosis, and I felt it. It's like I was tired. My energy was low.
Which for our listeners means he was well on the way to developing cirrhosis, or complete scarring of the liver, where you have a high risk of it not working and failing. And that is very dangerous.
Once you have a cirrhotic liver, there's no going back.
Yeah. And there's only 4 stages, and stage 3 is scary. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So my doctor, you know, thought it was... He held off for a few years because he knew there was a more gentle, softer way coming down the line without interferon, which would have been horrible, you know.
Yeah.
Before the new treatments, you guys know, and I don't know if your listeners know, like one of the main treatments was interferon with maybe some other things.
Ribavirin.
Ribavirin, yeah. And
brutal treatment. It would last, you know, up to 12 months. And in a regular normal case scenario, it would feel like you had the flu for a year.
Exactly. And it only worked 40% of the
only
time.
Only 40% exactly. success
in
rate.
In the best patient.
Yes, yeah. And that doesn't even include like being dual diagnosed with HIV too. Then your right. chances sure. are even lower.
Exactly right, yeah.
No, it's something that like doesn't get as much media attention as it should. The amazing scientific like achievement that it is that we are curing Hep C on like a daily basis. If again, if we you have a listener, anyone who thinks they might have it or thinks they know someone they have it, please see your doctor, because we can cure that with amazing over 90% success rate. So that's
my
a plug.
My insurance covered it too, which is amazing.
Wow, that's fantastic. Amazing.
Yeah. Joe has a question.
Sorry, Joe. No, yeah, just so amazed by the Hep C cure as well. And I got to think, you know, for someone in your position, do you, you know, Hep C, the cure, Hep C out of nowhere, that was a virus that was cured, that almost never happens. Did that give you an added hope for a cure for HIV, especially now with the treatment that's made you, your viral load so low, undetectable? It kind of gives me hope for a cure. Do you feel the same way?
I have, you know, I don't really think that with HIV. I think, yeah, someday there might be a cure and there probably will be. To be honest with you, and I don't know if this is selfish, but I'm very happy just having an undetectable viral load.
that's the goal.
I can't pass it on to my wife, and I can't pass it on to anyone else. And I can, you know, I can be healthy, and they're starting to give like life insurance to people with HIV now. It's just like, you know, we're going to live a long life and be, you know, normal pretty much. You know, that's seems to be the trend. So I don't really look at it that way. I think it would be great if there was a cure for HIV. That would be wonderful, but I'm not crossing my finger. I mean, I would love to see it. That would be amazing. That would be a wonderful thing. But just the fact that...
It sounds like you're grateful for what you got.
I'm grateful for what I got. And I'm grateful that there was a cure for the Hep C.
Totally.
Heard and we've talked about this in other shows. It's gosh, amazing treatment. Mm-hmm. Gotta ask you doctors, why not put everybody on PrEP or antivirals? PrEP no doctor's been able to answer that for me.
You mean why not put everybody in the world on PrEP?
It's in effect.
We don't even put everyone on the world on
not
aspirin.
The world, but as many
and
people as
now.
Possible.
People who are high risk, definitely I think PrEP is a wonderful thing.
High risk, exactly. There are two reasons
What's
why
the
not everyone.
Of high risk.
Lots of partners, unprotected sex.
Intravenous
those are like,
drug use or sharing sex. Needles, high sharing.
Sorry,
sex.
High risk sex. Yeah, sure. Exactly. Yeah. There's a whole category. It used to be, you know, gay men, and now it's people who gay men who have unprotected sex, specifically anal receptive. So if you're a bottom as opposed to a top, you're at higher risk because there's more trauma.
Yeah.
There's two reasons why not everybody's going to be on it right now. Cost. It's not free. It's not
Fair
cheap
enough.
Medicine, Truvada. And the other one is it's only been around for like 5 years. Who knows what the consequences are of any of these medications? You can't just start medications willy-nilly.
I got switched off Truvada to a different drug by my doctor because there's like, you know, he was worried about there might be issues with my kidneys after years of doing Truvada. So he thought maybe I could he'd get me off Truvada onto a different drug that seemed to not be so hard on the kidneys. So, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff like that.
Our goal is to have people on the least amount of medicine that we can and the least harmful amount of medicine that you can. So if someone doesn't need to be on medicine, you know. There's no reason to do it.
They're talking about nowadays even putting like a 6-month wafer under your skin for, which is kind of weird to me, but that's a new, you know, that's a possibility. And then you would not have to take a pill every day. Yeah. And it might be easier on your kidneys and liver and stuff.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all this with us. It's an amazing story. And it's so good to see where you're at now. After all that, and to hear you play is amazing. Your band is great.
Well, thank you
so
much.
It's one of my favorite blues bands.
Oh, man,
it's howledivine.com, howelldevine. They have a couple of albums. They have Delta Grooves, Boogies and Wobbles, and Howl, right? There's another album, right?
Yeah, and then Modern Sounds of Ancient Juju.
That's why I can't remember that one.
That's tricky.
Say that again.
If I just may brag, bragging rights for a second. We have two records on the legendary Arhuli record label, which is now part of the Smithsonian Folkway catalog. So That's very cool for us. We have two records on the Smithsonian catalog. Yeah, this will amazing. Be there forever.
Yeah.
After the apocalypse, maybe they'll, you know, be beaming our music up to the space station, and Howl Devine's music will live on forever. Who knows?
It's a great band, man.
And thank the band you. Plays a lot at Biscuits and Blues in San Francisco. So you said you had some upcoming shows. We'll post some of the dates when we have them. But I've seen them. They're great.
And Club Deluxe on Haight Street, we play there a lot. Cool. And that's a really fun nightclub to see us play live. Yeah. Yeah, let's go there.
Thank you so much for sharing. It's
thank you
awesome.
All very much for having me.
Thanks, Pete. Cool. That's so admirable.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Joe.
Two drummers. They love each other.
Yeah, man.
Drummer bonding.
All anecdotes and patient-related details have been changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.